The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from Clark County Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, and Wright Memorial Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's my pleasure to welcome back to the program today Lisa Scottolini. She joins us on the telephone in Pennsylvania. Hello, Lisa.
Vic, I love talking to you. I'm so glad to be able to do this. Thanks for having me.
Well, Lisa, I've been following you on Twitter, and I have noticed that you have done more pre-publication publicity than just about anyone I've ever seen. How many Zoom events did you do before the book came out?
I know. What's funny, I mean, to tell it short, this book is a bit of a departure for me, and I was super excited about it, and the pandemic hit, and I just was like, you know what? I had all these research videos, so I never have done this in my career, and actually, I've never seen another author do it, although I hope they start because I think it's good. So I had 20 videos, and way before PubMed, I just got on Facebook every Tuesday night and would show a research video, which I took in Rome because the book titled Eternal is set in Rome. And I thought, gee, you know, this is a way that they can see background about the book, which doesn't make it into the book because there was so much research. And also they can get out of the house. Like, it was kind of cool. Like, you see streets of Rome and me talking about it and Gestapo headquarters and fascist branch office and all this stuff. And so I did that for 4 months. And tonight, and every Tuesday night, and a month after Pub, I'm doing the last one tonight. We're kind of doing, it's called, eternally grateful giveaway, because there's so many themes in the novel. And one is, well, it's actually a novel set partly in World War II. And I think at heart, every war novel ends up being an anti-war novel. And so tonight we are giving giveaways to military service members and their families, and we'll do giveaways of the book. So I just wanted to talk about the book. I missed everybody. I live alone, and I thought I want to kind of bring them up to speed and introduce this new type of thing that I'm going to be writing in historical fiction. And happily, I think it worked out. I'm very pleased about it, and so thank you for asking.
You showed viewers Gelato headquarters. That's pretty cool.
No, I'm fascist brush Gestapo. I'm sorry.
Okay. The book is eternal, and this is quite a departure for you, Lisa. I get the feeling that you thought about this book for a really long time.
Like 40 years. Does that count?
40, huh? So 40, you started thinking about it before you were born?
Aren't you kind? God, Vic, I miss seeing you. I got the idea for it in college, because I was an English major at Penn and took a course with Philip Roth, which I still can't believe I was lucky enough to be in that class. But it was only 15 kids, and he introduced us to the works of Primo Levi, who was an Italian-Jewish chemist who wrote a memoir about his time in Auschwitz. And it was so moving, and I thought, I'm Italian-American. I sort of really identify with it. And I didn't really know about Italian Jews. And the more I learned, the more I said, someday, if you ever get to be a writer, if you ever, ever do, you should tell this story about what happened in Rome. And honestly, I got to be a writer. I've written like 33 novels at this point and 8 memoirs that are like humorous nonfiction in the style of Irma Bombeck, daughter of Dayton. And I said, finally, I feel ready. I felt like I finally had the chops to write this book, and that book is eternal.
What happened in Rome?
Well, you know what's interesting? It wasn't a singular event, so I'll tell it short because I also don't want to give too much away, because I really wanted it to be presented properly. Because I really felt like I didn't know much, even though I'd been a lawyer and a law professor. I didn't know much about what happened to the law during fascism, the 20 years, the Ventennio it's called, of Mussolini's reign, and what happened and why that matters to the Holocaust in Italy. So the book takes place over the 20-year time. It's really a love story, love triangle between these three best friends, a girl and two guys, and she's got to decide who she's going to choose. But as they're growing up and growing older, the fascists come to power, and they start enacting a whole series of anti-Semitic laws. Because in the beginning, Italy was so unique during the 1930s in that the rise of fascism was not in any way anti-Semitic. Jews were assimilated into Italian society. The mayor of Rome was Jewish. The intermarriage rate was 50%. So when fascism came along, Italian Jews joined it in the same proportion as Gentiles. Now, that's really interesting. Like, and that was fascinating to me because then I started to do more research and learned that, you know, we know that Rome is the center of Roman Catholicism. But I didn't realize until the research that the Jewish, so-called Jewish ghetto in Rome, which is across the river, like across the river from St. Peter's, is the oldest continuously existing Jewish community in Western civilization. So what I really wanted to do is show what happened to the Jews during the rise of fascism. And it was really death by a thousand cuts. It was, you know, first they took away their property, then they took away the possessions, then they took away the citizenship, then they said you're thrown out of the fascist party. So it really ends up being a book about identity. And when that happens, at the end of this horrible thing, of this horrible series of laws, Italy enters the war on the side of the Nazis and ultimately surrenders. What the fascists did in Rome set up the Jews of Rome for what the Nazis would do. So the event is what the Nazis did. But you can't tell it alone. It's a course of conduct, and it's a horrifying course of conduct. So I really wanted to take the time, you know, and as a person interested in the effect of law and justice on everyday people, you know, and what happens to justice when the laws are themselves unjust. The laws perpetrate injustice and murder. Now what do you do? Hmm. That's really an interesting question, and that's the kind of stuff that's lurking under Eternal.
Lisa Scottolini joins us on the program today. We're talking about her new novel, and you mentioned this love triangle. Introduce us to these three characters.
Right. I mean, it's, you know, I never know how a book's going to end. Like people say, do you know how it ends? And I don't even know how it middles. Like, I don't know anything, which is not very impressive, but is absolutely true. So I started thinking, well, you got to make all of these events. You know, it's like I've written 30 books, which people call thrillers or family dramas or whatever they call them. I always think the story is about families, and there's some element of justice in them. So I said to myself, "Don't be not afraid, Lisa," because I was intimidated. This is just going to be a story of a family set in a different time. However, it's also the story of three families because the protagonist kind of is Elisabetta, who's a young girl who's growing up in fascist Italy, not very political, wants to be a journalist, which turns out to be the exactly wrong profession to pick when fascism is censoring newspapers. So she's not sure what to do. She has a tough home life. Her father has struggles with alcoholism. Her mother is kind of absent. And she falls in love with her two best friends. She falls in love with one, Sandro, who's Jewish, kind of a math prodigy who lives in the ghetto, and the other, Marco, who's kind of a brash, sexy cyclist who is kind of like showy. And he kind of takes her out of her comfort zone while Sandro is a really good listener. So I thought when I started this, I thought I also wanted to write a book that's about love and not just romantic love, but more about the love that people have for one another. And so these three friends are friends in the beginning, and when they all kind of, when both boys fall in love with Elisabetta and she was trying to decide, you know that it's kind of no win. So I'm sitting there writing this book going, oh my God, how is this going to end? Like, who is she going to choose? I don't even know. And at the same time, the boys don't hate each other. They're good. They're dear. They're best friends. So there's that love. And there's this overarching idea of that, you know, that the antidote to the hate of fascism and Nazism is really love. And so it's a book that really is suffused, I think, despite these really dramatic and tough times, with that notion. You know, when you try to think about what you're going to, like, quote you're going to use at the beginning of a book, and I read a lot. I read all the time. I'm always, so that would be cool. This is cool. And the one I wanted to put was, love conquers all things. And then I took it off because I said, man, that's kind of hokey. Like, you should be able, that sounds like a greeting card, you know, kind of like Scottolini, like, you should be throwing better heat than that kind of thing. But when the more I thought about it, writing this novel and working through what happened with these characters, and I said, that is actually the answer. Like, John Lennon was kind of right. Like, love really is the answer. And it's just more true. I mean, it's the great thing about writing about history. You just lay out the facts, which honestly no popular American novel has ever done. No one's ever told the story of what happened to the Jews of Rome in popular American fiction. And so I was like, this is a heavy responsibility, particularly, and then I'll shut up, because even though I've written about law and justice, and I never have written about something where real people died. and they needed, what happened to them needed to be brought to light, if not to justice, to light. And I wanted to honor them. One of the many research trips I took for this, I went back to the 75th anniversary of the event that is sort of the culmination of what the Nazis did in October 1943 to the Jews of Rome. And I met survivors, you know, and I sat among them. And it is really moving. And you realize when you're writing about it, even though you're writing it in fiction, you have to really honor that memory. And I hope I did.
You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. Lisa Scottolini returning to the program to talk about her new novel, Eternal. And Lisa has made a number of appearances on the program over the years, going back to at least 1996 from what I can see in my records. And if you're tuning in for Why So Weekend right now, you're probably thinking, well, gee whiz, what happened to Why So Weekend? Well, Jerry took the week off, so we're giving you an extra special hour-long Sunday edition of the Book Nook instead. So we'll keep bringing you the Book Nook right up until 11 o'clock this morning. And if you tune in for the Book Nook on Saturday morning, you're used to hearing an hour-long conversation. So there's a little bonus for you this weekend. 2 hours of the Book Nook this weekend. And I have another bonus for you. Lisa Scottolini's audiobook version of Eternal is out. And she's got these three main protagonists, Elisabetta, Marco, and Sandro. And we get points of view from all these characters and some others throughout the novel. And right now, I'm going to bring you an excerpt from the audiobook from early in the story. This is Elisabetta.
Chapter 1. Elisabetta, May 1937. Elisabetta made up her mind. Marco Terizzi would be her first kiss. She watched him doing bicycle tricks by the river, riding on his back tire, his head thrown back in laughter, his teeth white against his tanned face. His thick dark hair shone with pomade in the sun, and his legs were knotted with muscles inside the baggy shorts of his uniform. He rode with joy and athleticism, achieving a masculine grace. Marco Terizzi had sprezzatura, a rare and effortless charm that made him irresistible. Elisabetta couldn't take her eyes from him, and neither could the others. They had grown up together, but somewhere along the line, he had gone from boyhood to manhood, from Marco to Marco. That he was terribly handsome, there could be no doubt. He had large walnut brown eyes, a strong nose, a square jaw, and a broad neck marked by a prominent Adam's apple. He was the most popular boy in their class, and everything about him seemed more vivid than everyone else. Even now, the sun drenched him in gold, as if nature herself gilded him. Elisabetta wondered what it would be like to kiss him. She guessed it would be exciting, even delicious, like biting into a ripe tomato and letting its juices run down her chin. She had never kissed a boy, though she was already 15 years old, and at night she practiced kissing on her pillow. Her tabby cat, Rico, with whom she slept, had grown accustomed to her routine, as cats endure the silliness of young girls. Elisabetta had no idea how to make Marco think of her as more than a friend. She usually achieved what she set her mind to, getting good grades and such, but this was different. She was too blunt to flirt. She lacked feminine wiles. She had been a maschiaccio, a tomboy when she was little, which was how she had grown close with Marco. She was trying to become more womanly, but she still didn't wear a brassiere. Her mother said she didn't need one. But the other girls made fun of her, talking behind their hands. Elisabetta, help! I'll drown! Marco raced toward the river, and she was about to call to him but stopped herself. She had read in a female advice column that denying men the attention they craved drove them mad with desire. So she ignored him, while the other girls responded. Marco, no! Livia called back. Marco, be careful, Angela gasped. The boys waited to see if calamity befell Marco, but he cranked the handlebars, veering away from the river's edge. They laughed and returned to their textbooks, spread out on the grass. They were doing homework, having come from their Balila meeting, the party's compulsory youth group. They all wore their uniforms, the boys in their black shirts and gray shorts, and the girls in white muslin shirts and black skirts. This quiet spot on the riverbank, just north of the Ponte Palatino, had become a hangout of her classmates after school, though Elisabetta typically sat with Marco or Sandro, apart from the other girls. Somehow, she had missed her chance to become their girlfriend, and it was too late now, for they rebuffed her overtures. Perhaps they had judged her as preferring the boys, which wasn't true, and she would have loved to have had a good girlfriend. Whatever the reason, Angela and the other girls kept her at a distance, and she tried not to let it bother her. Look, Betta, Marco called again, using her childhood nickname. Use my proper name, Elisabetta called back from behind her newspaper. She did prefer her full name, as she hoped to become a journalist someday. She practiced her byline at night, too. By Elisabetta d'Orfeo. Elisabetta! Marco rode over, sliding to a stop on the grass. Hop on my handlebars. Let's go for a ride. No, I'm reading. Elisabetta hid her smile behind the newspaper. Angela rose, brushing grass from her skirt. Marco, I'll go. Take me. Okay. Marco extended his hand. Angela clambered onto his handlebars, and the two rode off together. Elisabetta lowered her newspaper, wondering if the female advice column had been wrong. If she wanted Marco, she would have to attract him another way. She sensed she was pretty enough, now that she had grown into her features, according to her mother. Her large, round eyes were greenish-brown, and her shoulder-length hair was a rich brunette, wavy and abundant. Her nose was strong, but proportional to her prominent cheekbones, and her lips were full. Her problem was her bocca grande, big mouth, which proved a disadvantage when it came to boys, her Latin teacher, and that old bitch at the newsstand. Elisabetta leaned back on her elbows, breathing in the odors of the Tiber, its water a milky jade with wavelets topped with ivory foam. Swallows skimmed the surface for a drink. Cicadas rasped and dragonflies droned. Pink oleander bushes, umbrella pines, and palm trees lined the riverbank, and the natural oasis was shielded from the hustle-bustle of the city by gray stone walls. Elisabetta's gaze found the Ponte Rotto in the middle of the river, a bizarre sight. Centuries ago, the stone bridge had connected the riverbanks, but time had reduced it to only a single arch rising from the water, leading nowhere. Romans called it the Broken Bridge, but she thought that it was a survivor, standing despite the elements and the Tiber itself, which sent blackish-green vines up its sides, as if trying to pull it underwater. Beyond the Ponte Rotto was Tiber Island, the only island in the river, barely large enough to contain the Basilica di San Bartolomeo all'Isola, with its faded brick belfry, the Church of San Giovanni Calibita, and the hospital, Ospedale Fatte Bene Fratelli, with its rows of green shuttered windows. Across from the hospital was Bar Girosport, which Marco's family owned and lived above. Elisabetta lived only a few blocks away from him in Trastevere, the bohemian neighborhood that she and her father loved. Unfortunately, Her mother had ceased loving anything.
You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, amplifying voices from every corner of our community. My guest is Lisa Scottolini. We're talking about her novel, Eternal. And you mentioned that as you began writing the story, you didn't know which guy, Marco or Sandro, Elisabetta was going to choose, but we knew.
Did we?
We knew when we're reading the book, we know who she's going to pick.
I went back and forth. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I haven't had a date in like a millennium, so I'm like, who would I choose?
We know.
Well, in a funny way, it's a surprise ending then, but we can't discuss it.
Okay, right.
I hear you.
Okay, tell us about the ghetto in Rome, because a lot of us have heard about the ghetto in Warsaw and various other ghettos where Jews were forced to live over periods of history. Tell us about the Roman one, because this is kind of a unique one.
It really is. I mean, partly that, and I've visited over years, so I've seen the changes. And I will tell you that when I first went, the first time I was shown it, because I'm lucky enough to have my other books published in Italy, so I toured there, and my Italian publisher said, oh, let's go to the ghetto. We'll have the artichokes. And I was like, what? You know, like, and then the more I learned, and we did that, and I thought, this is really hallowed ground. You know, a war crime. Let's be real. A war crime was committed in the center of Rome in full view of the Vatican. So I was like, what is this? You know, I had to really explore it. Now, back then, there wasn't even a memorial. There wasn't really anything. I only knew about it because I knew about it. Over the years, I saw there's a plaque, and now there's a tiny museum, and it's wonderful. But, you know, I think what's the most remarkable thing about it is that you can walk through the ghetto, which isn't very large, and not know its history and still not realize that you're walking on a place where a war crime took place. And that bothers me. You know, when I consulted all these historians after I did all this reading, because I'm like a freak, so I read constantly, and I watched every movie and read a lot of stuff that was contemporaneous fiction just to get a sense of the way the speech would go, because you had to change my voice a little to write this novel. You can't write it like I'm talking now. I'm pure South Philly, and that is not going to fly. It's anachronistic, you know. So I remember I did talk to one historian who I won't name, and I said, you know, why was what happened in Rome in October 1943 not the subject of a Nuremberg-like trial with worldwide attention and, you know, globally televised? And he said, nobody wanted another Nuremberg. Mm-hmm. And I thought, ooh, that's really dark and also wrong. You know, my sense of justice was offended. And here you are, much later, you're just a normal lady from the suburbs. The perpetrators are gone. The victims are gone. Their families, to the extent that they survived, are still around. But what can you do about that to set that right? Well, the only thing you can do is tell the story of it. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I did. Mm-hmm. But so the ghetto is unique in many ways, and that's one of them.
So you're from South Philly. I thought you went to Lower Merion and Upper Derby.
I did. You know, they moved on up.
Oh, okay.
They got a, not right. That there's anything wrong with South Philly, but they moved to the suburbs. And I've lived in every county in Philadelphia, around Philadelphia. So I'm really worldly wise, aren't I?
Okay, well, I remember when I went to St. Andrews, we used to row against Upper Merion and Lower Derby.
Oh, yeah.
Crew. Uh-huh.
Yeah, I bet. You guys are probably better.
Well, that particular year that we rode against you, our team won the international championship at the Henley Regatta in England. So, yeah, they were pretty good. But
did you know that I rode? I rode for Penn. I was one of Penn's first women crew.
Well, I knew Penn had a great rowing program, so I'm not surprised. Did you row at Lower Merion and Upper Derby?
No, because they wouldn't let girls.
Oh, okay.
Back then, my picture hangs on the boathouse wall as one of the first women crew members, and I took my daughter to see it, and she said, Mom, you were a pioneer. I'm like, oh, man, that does that.
That's pretty cool.
It was cool. Rowing is great. Mm. Rowing is a great sport. I should have known you were a rower.
No, I wasn't. I played baseball. My guest is Lisa Scottolini. We're talking about Eternal, and I want to hear some more about the story. I know you're not going to do spoilers, but tell us more about the story. We've got the fascists. We've got one guy, Sandro, who father who thinks the fascists are cool.
Right.
His dad is probably the most tragic figure in this whole story.
Yeah, I love his dad. Well, when the story opens, everybody's a fascist. I didn't tell you that right away. I don't really say what the uniforms are. It just kind of dawns on you. Because for me, it was sort of an examination. And Primo Levi, I'm not going to analogize myself, but he had such insight. So I was a little bit like, try to figure out what makes someone a good fascist. Why do people choose it? And I thought I sort of had it with Marco, because here's Elisabetta, who's kind of artsy and not really political and sort of congenitally leftist. You know, as an artist, she's kind of like liberal.
Mm-hmm.
And here is Marco, and he has a secret. It came to me. I was like, this is interesting, because he can't read very well. A modern reader will recognize him as having dyslexia.
Mm-hmm.
So then I got to research about 1930s Rome. What did they know about dyslexia then? And they didn't know much. And they called it word blindness. And of course, like a lot of dyslexic people, I think this is probably still certainly a little bit true, that there's a self-esteem issue. Marco cannot understand why he can't read. He just feels stupid. His best friend, Sandra, is a genius. His girlfriend devours books. He can't compete. He really wants her heart, so he kind of wants to compete with his best friend for her. But he feels at a distinct disadvantage, and he learns all of these tricks, which I did the research about. You know, he learns how to move his eyes across the page and how to raise his hand in class so he doesn't get called on. So everything is, all of his strategies are to prevent anybody from knowing that he can't read. And certainly when he becomes employed by the fascists. So then what happens is a little bit, he feels bad about himself. And along comes Mussolini, and Marco, the message that grabs him is when Mussolini, that ultra-nationalism that characterized Mussolini, it was called Italianità and Romanità. The idea is, you are so Italian, and because you are Italian, that is special. Like, we are the glory that was Rome. Like, the more research I did, the more I learned that kind of Hitler copied Mussolini and not the other way around.
Mm.
So that ultra-nationalism really spoke to a guy like Marco, who feels inferior. And so he can say, well, maybe I can't read, but nobody knows that. And I'm smart because I was bought in Rome. Look at the glory of Rome. Look at it's all around me. He happens to live. I located what his house would be right on Tiber Island. There was one little place there that I used, and all these videos are on my website. They can see it. But so I sort of wanted to examine what, because to me, you know, there's some great quote, all books are about identity to a certain extent. You know, if you're writing a character-driven novel, which I think I am, you want to understand what Marco finds in fascism and also how he loses his way. So for a while, he's thinking about himself. He dons the fascist uniform. But after a while, when he sees what it starts to do, he goes, am I my uniform? Who am I? Same with Sandro's father, who is a fascist, a dedicated fascist, as many Jews were, then is thrown out of the party, and then is stripped of Italian citizenship because he's Jewish.
Hmm.
He says to himself, who am I? Who am I if I'm not a fascist? Who am I if I'm not Italian? And so all of these questions were really just there for the taking. Like, if you were looking, you could pull that string and emphasize that with these characters. But it was sort of interesting, and it ended up being the arc of Italy. It ended up being the arc of the Ventennio. If you look at Marco and his father being a dedicated fascist, a fascist of the first hour, as they were called, who also fought in World War I. I mean, these World War I and World War II are practically back-to-back. So you see how Italy lost its way. And I thought, in a way, it became very understandable at a human level that the country foundered and then lost its way and perpetrated this injustice and crime and then began to crawl out of it. And it was really, it's a bigger scope than anything I've ever done before. And although thematically it's the same, family, love, justice, it's on a much bigger scale. And as I say, has this added responsibility that was a true life event. So it was just really a cool book. I mean, I'm just really proud of it. I've never listened to the audiobook of one of my books before, and I've listened to this one three times like a freak just because, and it's no credit to me. It's really remarkable to hear this performance and hear how different artists interpret something. It's just, It's just, I feel very, very lucky and very blessed to be have written it and to be talking to you about it. I hope I'm not sounding too crazy or caffeinated. Probably both.
You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. And over the years that I've been hosting this program, I've had a number of interviews with Lisa Scottolini, and she is one of my favorite people to interview. She's come out to Yellow Springs for a number of interviews over the years, and of course now we're doing everything by phone with this pandemic going on, and she has been incredibly busy. She has been on Facebook and on Twitter and doing Zoom constantly. She's the busiest person I know in publishing, forward promoting this novel. And as she just mentioned, the audiobook version of Eternal is pretty special. And we have the voices of Sandro, Elisabetta, and Marco. And Sandro is short for Alessandro. And he is quite a character. He lives with his family in the ghetto. They are Jewish, the ghetto of Rome. And he is very perceptive. He is very intelligent. He's a mathematical genius. And as the story opens, he's very ambitious. He's fallen in love with Elisabetta, as has Marco. And this love triangle really powers the story. And the audiobook gives us Sandro's voice talking about his feelings and the way he thinks about Elisabetta and his rivalry with Marco for her affection. And Sandro stole this reader's heart. He's really an amazing character. And so we're going to bring you an audiobook excerpt of Sandro's viewpoint from Eternal as a special bonus on this hour-long Book Nook on your Sunday. As we preempted WYSO weekend today, we won't do it again. Next week, we'll be back to our regular schedule, okay? But that's your little bonus. And as part of that, we've been giving you just some little excerpts from the audiobook. And so here we go with another one. This is our final excerpt from Eternal with a view of Sandro on WYSO.
Chapter 3. Sandro. May 1937. Later, Sandro sat alone at the dining room table. The night air wafted through the window, and the crystal chandelier shed a gentle light on his notebook. His family had just had dinner, and he was supposed to be working, but his head was full of Elisabetta. He didn't understand how to think about anything else while you were in love. He marveled that people did so, every day. He had never felt anything so intensely in his life. His intellect enabled him to think so much, but perhaps until now he'd felt too little. He couldn't stop thinking about when he'd kissed her, by the river, the thrilling closeness of her body, nearer to him than ever before. He loved everything about her, especially the way she regarded him. As his intellectual abilities had come to the fore, everyone treated him differently, whether for good or ill. The teachers adored him, but his classmates thought him odd. Elisabetta did neither. She had liked him from the beginning, for who he was inside, and so he could be himself with her. Sandro's gaze strayed out the window. The Simones lived in one of the houses lining the elegant Piazza Mattei on the ghetto's north side. Their apartment was on the third floor, catter-corner to the refined Palazzo Costa Guti, and he could see his neighbors through their windows. Giovanni Rotoli was doing homework at the table, and on the floor below him, the Nardunos, an older couple, were sharing the newspaper. The ghetto was typically quiet at night, and the only sound was the water bubbling in the Fontana delle Tartarughe below, the Fountain of the Turtles. Sandro loved living in the ghetto, which was the oldest living Jewish community in Western civilization. The community was established nearly 2,000 years ago, when Jerusalem had fallen to the Emperor Titus, who had sacked the temple and brought Jews back to Rome as slaves. The conquest was commemorated in the Grand Arch of Titus in the Roman Forum, which Gentiles viewed as a majestic arch but many Jews considered a symbolic yoke. In 1555, the ghetto was created, and Pope Paul IV had ordered that walls be built surrounding the neighborhood, with doors that were locked at night and guards on patrol, for which the community had to pay. There were thousands of Jews in Rome at the time, and they were compelled to wear yellow badges and forced to live in the ghetto, packed into about 130 homes on a handful of city blocks that encompassed less than 3 hectares, or 7 acres. It was considered the least desirable neighborhood in Rome, situated on low-lying ground that flooded every winter from the Tiber, bringing malaria and other diseases. Its streets were narrow and dark, permitting little light or circulation of air. Churches were built at its entrances, and Jews were forced to listen to sermons pressuring them to convert. The ghetto walls were torn down in 1888, after Rome had been absorbed into the new nation of Italy in 1870, and Jews were permitted to come and go. The ghetto was cleaned, and an embankment built around the Tiber to prevent flooding. A beautiful synagogue, the Tempio Maggiore, was consecrated in 1904, with its square dome that distinguished it from the hundreds of churches with round ones. Some said that the synagogue was designed to be the tallest building in Rome, since St. Peter's Basilica was technically in Vatican City, and it became the spiritual home of the community. Many Roman Jews still lived in the ghetto, although those with means had moved away. Sandro's house had been in his father's family for generations, so the Simones would never dream of leaving, though they were far better off than their neighbors. Sandro's thoughts were interrupted by bickering from the kitchen, where his sister Rosa and his mother had begun fussing. His father Massimo was in his study, and Sandro heard him close his door. Rosa, an interpreter at the British Embassy, could argue in 5 languages. Suddenly, his sister burst from the kitchen, smoothing her hair into its dark, glossy twist. She was a beauty, with quick brown eyes, a straight nose, and lips that looked full, especially when she wore lipstick. She was 10 years older than Sandro, and always dressed stylishly, tonight in a blue suit with a tiny belt. Rosa's disconcerted gaze found Sandro at the table.
She drives me crazy!
What's the matter?
I want to go to London.
Rosa came over and sat down.
I got the time off, and I'm spending my own money, but she says I can't go. I'm an adult, and I can make my own decisions.
If you're an adult, why ask permission? Rosa hesitated.
If I go, she'll get mad.
She'll get over it. You always forgive each other.
Maybe you're right.
I know I am. Rosa eyed his notebook. What are you working on? Would I understand?
No.
Sandro wondered if Rosa might have advice for him about Elisabetta. To tell you the truth, I'm not getting much done. I'm in love.
You're too young to be in love.
You're too old to ask permission. Rosa laughed.
But you look so serious. You don't seem happy about it.
What's more serious than love? Sandro didn't add that Elisabetta was a girl to be taken seriously. He doubted his sister would understand, as her hobby was cynicism.
Okay, who are you in love with?
Elisabetta. Sandro loved saying her name.
You pal around with her and Marco like you're the Three Musketeers. You treat her like one of the boys.
Rosa looked at him like he was crazy.
Do you think women like that? Genius?
Sandro didn't think anyone was a genius about women, except Marco.
So, what are you saying? Do you have some advice?
Of course. Rosa shifted closer.
Start by telling her you like her hair or her dress, and that she looks pretty. That will lay the foundation, and she'll be more inclined to you. Don't say it all at once. Spread it over a few days. Give love time to work.
You make it sound like magic.
It is, in a way. And bring her a gift. What does she like?
Newspapers.
I meant something romantic, like flowers.
Books are romantic. She likes to read. Rosa rolled her eyes.
Fine, a book. Then after you have done those things, tell her you love her and kiss her. Sandro hadn't realized he was supposed to bring gifts, then kiss her. Evidently there were steps, like a mathematical proof, and he had done them out of order. He felt stupid, a sensation he disliked. What if she sees me only as a friend? Be optimistic. Your feelings grew, maybe hers did too. What if she likes somebody else? Rosa smiled warmly. That's not possible. Who's better than you? Marco? Oh, no. Rosa's smile faded. Does Marco like her too? Marco's better, isn't he? Rosa burst into laughter. No, I was kidding. Really? Really? Sandro didn't believe her. But he didn't ask again.
In case you're just tuning in, my guest is Lisa Scottolini. We're talking about her new novel, Eternal, and she thinks her book is character-driven. After 33 books, I think she knows when her books are character-driven. This one is certainly character-driven. We have favorite main characters. Mine was Sandro. We have favorite peripheral characters. Mine were the two cats. But if I had to pick a favorite peripheral human, it would be Nana.
Oh.
I loved her.
That's so nice of you to say, because now I get all choked up. My mom, I've never done that, but my mom's spirit is really in Nana. We lost her this time of year a couple of years ago, and it's just I wanted it, and I didn't mean it. I mean, I really didn't intend it. You know, you really do figure out what these, my only way I've ever written a novel is very organic. What would this character do next? And so Elizabeth has to get a job because she has to support herself. And I liked that spirit in her, that she's like so many women I know, and men too, but this is her story, that she just keeps going.
Mm.
And, you know, in the beginning, it came to me in the beginning of the novel, she says something, she became aware that she was lower class, which she hadn't really understood at some point. But by the end of the war, she realized there's only one class that matters, and that's survivors.
Mm-hmm.
So she has to get a job, and she works as a waitress. I was a waitress. And she, you know, she meets the restaurant owner, who's a woman, who's a matriarch, Nana, and everyone calls her that, grandmother. And I thought, you know, this is interesting, because she needs a mother figure. But the great thing about Nana, and I think is the heart of my mother too. My mother was incredibly loving, like, you know, all kissy and huggy. But she was a bit of a wise guy. She had a great sense of humor. And she always answered a question with a question, you know, like I'd say, how you doing? She's like, who wants to know? You know, like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I gave Nana a little of that, because while you want drama and emotionality, I don't want to go over the top or make it mawkish. And you know, these women weren't like that. I mean, a woman who runs a restaurant, she's a character.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so is Elisabetta. Elisabetta's been acting in an adult world for a long time. So I think she doesn't realize what she needs, but she finds it in Nana. And so it's a minor character, but I try to make all the characters work, even if they're minor. But that one is my favorite, too.
And Nana proves something that we all know intuitively, and that is food is love.
Yeah.
And I remember the first time, I think it was one of the first times I interviewed you. It was probably 25 years ago. You came out to Yellow Springs, and you had a story, an anecdote about one time you were with your mom, and there was a woman going by in a car, and she, like, made a face at you, and you said, who is that? And it turned out it was your aunt, right?
Yes.
Okay, we're not going to tell that story again, though.
But it's kind of crazy, but you're right.
Because, okay, I got news stories that I want to hear. And here's one. You already mentioned Philip Roth, and I had Blake Bailey on the day the book was published, his Philip Roth, The Biography. He corrected me. I called it A Biography. He said, no, it's The Biography. You're in the book, Lisa, because you were at Penn, and you're mentioned in the book. And
what?
You haven't read that book?
No, I actually haven't. I've been working so hard on tour, and I haven't read it yet.
You're in the book, Lisa.
Oh, wow.
You read all these books. You haven't read that one. I can't believe you haven't read that.
Well, I hope I can get a copy.
No one's mentioned to you that you're in the book?
No. Well, no one reads as much as you.
Oh, come on now.
Well, I can just tell you, this is news to me.
You're in the book.
What did they say?
You just have to read it. It's 800 pages. And at the time, Philip Roth was teaching at Penn.
Right.
And it talks about Blake Bailey. And now in retrospect, reading what he has to say about Roth checking out these young co-eds at Penn, and now the scandal about Blake Bailey.
No, let me just say one thing. We got to be real clear. I was in that course with 15 kids, right? It's a year-long course. Do you know, not once did we all call to Mr. Roth. I never spoke to him outside the class, except for once. They invited us to a party at somebody's house, and there was a cat there. I'm a big cat person and a dog person. And I didn't know what to say. I was so nervous around him. And I said, I like cats. And he said, I do too. Like, that was the sum total. So for what it's worth, I don't know Blake Bailey from Adam, but I would never want to impugn Mr. Roth. I don't know the guy. I don't know anything untoward about him. I thought it was a great class, I got to tell you. Every week you sit there, we'd read a novel, he would lecture for 2 hours. Uh-huh. It was like I always say it was like taking physics from Einstein, because you read Flaubert, for example, and he'd break it down. Here's why this book works. Here's why this paragraph works. Get from macro to micro. Here's why this sentence works. Here's why this sentence matters. Here's why he chose this verb.
Uh-huh.
It was crazy great. It was like boot camp for people who love books.
Oh, it sounds
also
great.
So I will get this. I will see what they said, but I don't want to suggest there was any relationship with Philip Roth. There wasn't.
I'm not impugning Mr. Roth.
Oh, okay. I
I'm not impugning Blake Bailey. These are only allegations, but
right.
Suddenly he went from having the biggest book on the planet to having his agent drop him, having his publisher say, we're not doing a second printing. The day it all fell apart, he canceled his Twitter account. I mean, this guy has gone into serious hiding. You're not following this scandal?
Oh, I totally am following it. I did see it. It's horrifying. And I'll be interested to see what happens with it. And I don't think you were impugning, but I just wanted to make clear to anybody listening, Mr. Roth never did anything weird.
I'm not saying he did.
I just
read the book, which is apparently the only book you have not read, Lisa.
I think that's kind of true.
Well, I think Eternal is a landmark for you. And is this the first one with a new publisher?
No, it's the second one.
Oh,
the first one was a domestic thriller, and I'll still do those. But thank you, because I think that too. I mean, because you have such great people on your show, you really try, not to sound pretentious, but artistically, to do something different and bigger. And I'm not getting any younger. You know, I really wanted to. It's something I always wanted to explore. And I know you have a lot of people who listen who want to write. And I really want to encourage them and to take risks, like in your writing, because I think I've done that. And I'm just so happy that I did. The reviews are really wonderful, and the online reviews are great, which is nice. And but I still, even if they weren't, I felt glad the day I sent it off to the publisher. I was like, you did this, kid. You can, you know, you did it. I actually thought you can die happy, which is a little dark, but that is what I thought.
And it's almost 500 pages. Is this the biggest book you've written?
No, and I think, but it was work to get it down to a manageable length. And I just think there was just so much to tell if you were going to do it right. I didn't want to narrow the scope. I was trying to write something. I'm swinging for the fences here. You have to really try to write something. I didn't want to just write. I wanted to write something that really, really encompassed what this whole time period was like and also make it human. You know, that's why it sort of opens with Elisabetta trying to get a bra. Like, part of me going, gee, I remember what it was like, and this experience she has with a mean girl's at school tell her she needs to get a bra, and that happened to me. And it's a good thing that girls remember, and for a long time you hold your books against your chest or your book bag and you're shy, and I wanted to make it real and make it personal, and it took a lot, so it makes me happy to hear you say that. I'm really, really honored, because, you know, I know that I just think the world of you.
Well, Lisa, we've had done a number of interviews over the years, and the only complaint I have about you is that it's really hard to get you to talk.
I know. I was looking forward to this all week. I'm like, I get to talk. I'm sorry. Your readers are probably like, I know why she's divorced twice, because she never shuts up.
Ouch.
But I'm excited. What can I tell you?
Well, congratulations, Lisa. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
My guest has been Lisa Scottolini. You heard about Eternal on The Book Nook. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis.